Hello and a very warm welcome to Midori House, live from Studio One here at Monocle 24 with me, Emma Nelson. In the next hour, we'll be looking to the year ahead in Asia with help from leading thinkers and correspondents in the region.
The Indian-Pakistani relationship is, I would hesitate to say good, but at least it is stable. There is a dialogue again that's started up over the last few months.
Also coming up, we'll be joined by the author of The Optimism Bias, a book that takes a cold, hard look at the sunny side of life. We'll also be assessing the resurgence of the Bible in Norway, as a new version makes it a bestseller.
Tar jeg morgenrødens vinger på, og slår meg ned der havet ender, så fører du meg også der, din høyre hånd, den holder meg fast.
We'll be looking at the year ahead too in the world of branding with the director of the Creative Review. All that plus some great music too. That's all here on Midori House, live from Studio One in London. All that coming up in the next 60 minutes. First of all though, let's get the latest news from around the world with Christine Yeo.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Christian Yeo. Republican candidate for President Mitt Romney says he's delighted to win the Iowa caucuses, but sees a long road ahead. The former Massachusetts governor narrowly beat Rick Santorum and Ron Paul to lead the ballot in the first Republican vote of the year. The focus now turns to New Hampshire. Mr. Romney says he won't be complacent with his early victory.
Just a few weeks ago, we were way behind in the polls. We were able to do pretty darn well last night. And of course, I've also been building a national campaign and making campaign appearances in states that are coming up down the road. I want to make sure that this is not just a one-state send-off, but instead we're able to get the delegates we need to get the nomination. So it's a long road ahead.
Meanwhile, it's been reported that Michelle Bachmann has suspended her bid for the White House. Bachmann, who trailed last in the Iowa vote, is reassessing her campaign. A young German man recently arrested in Los Angeles for allegedly setting 53 cars on fire over the New Year holiday is also accused of arson in Germany. Prosecutors in Marburg, near Frankfurt, say they're investigating the 24-year-old over a fire at his former home in Schwalm-Eder district in October. His timber house was set alight, prompting police at the time to place him under suspicion. Nigeria's main unions have called for a national strike and mass protests starting from Monday in response to the government lifting fuel subsidies. Yesterday, protesters shut down petrol stations, formed barriers along motorways, and hijacked buses in Lagos in anger at the sudden doubling of fuel prices. One demonstrator was reported to have been shot dead. Automaker Ford says it expects the vehicle market to grow by 5% a year for the next 2 years, led by China and India. The company's investing $142 million in its 200,000-vehicle-a-year plant in Chennai, in southern India, where its Fiesta and Figo models are built. The firm's also chosen India's Auto Expo in New Delhi as the venue at which to unveil its latest model. Michael Bonan, from the head of Ford India, says the company expects strong growth until at least 2020.
70% of all of our growth is going to come out of the Asia-Pacific region. India and China obviously are the two major players there. From an India perspective, we see ourselves growing, the industry growing from about 3.2 million in 2011 to around 9 million.
And European shares fell slightly today, ending 4 days of gains. The fall was led by banks after Italian lender UniCredit priced a rights issue at a massive discount, highlighting the struggle the sector faces to raise funds. Shares in UniCredit plunged 14.5%. And Argentine President Cristina Fernandez is recovering well after undergoing surgery for thyroid cancer. A spokesman says the operation was carried out without any complication. President Fernandez is expected to spend the next 72 hours recovering in hospital. Those are the stories at the top of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Christian, thank you very much indeed. Now a look at the global weather with Thomas Schaffernecker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel. Here's Europe's outlook first, and the windy weather will continue across the northern half of Europe rest of the week. Rough weather for Holland and Germany in the coming 24 hours. More delays to flights are likely because of those high winds. Snow and wind will hit the Alps too, 20 to 30 centimetres likely over the next 48 hours. By Friday, the central Mediterranean will have poorer weather too. Here's Thursday's city outlook. In London, 9 degrees, windy with some sunshine. Frankfurt, 8 Celsius, very windy with rain. Stockholm, plus 1 and sunny. In Moscow, plus 2, a rain and snow mix. In North America now, Florida is suffering from the cold. Wednesday morning, minus 6 degrees in Tallahassee there in North Florida. Miami, only plus 6, so very chilly for the subtropics. And of course, cold across other parts of the United States, all the way from New York down to Atlanta, but at least it's crisp and sunny. And if you want some sunshine, California is the place to be. Here's Thursday's city outlook. In Miami, 21 degrees with sunshine. Washington, D.C., 7 and sunny. New York, 6 Celsius and sunny. In Vancouver, 7 degrees with some rain showers. And let's have a look at other parts of the world for the next 48 hours. In Japan, we have chilly weather. The temperatures across most of Japan by day, anywhere from 10 degrees in the warmer south in Kyushu to 8 in Tokyo, and below zero in Sapporo, where snow showers are expected the next couple of days. China, Hong Kong, 14 Celsius, lots of cloud here. Shanghai, 6, also cloudy. And finally, Beijing, minus 2 degrees with sunshine and a few flurries. That's it. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Thomas. It's 6 minutes past the hour and you're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 highlight, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 e Yorkosa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Propojalava.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24. You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And for the first week of a brand new year on Monocle 24, we've been talking to academics, professionals and industry leaders about the outlook for the next 12 months. Continuing our global briefing series all this week, Monocle's foreign editor Steve Bloomfield recently sat down with the senior fellow at Chatham House, Zania Dormandy, and the Monocle contributor Daniela Pellad to discuss the year ahead in Asia.
India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, you know, next year we're going to start to move towards a place where the US and NATO are going to aim to pull out their troops by 2014, their combat troops by 2014. We've had a sort of a failure of any sort of peace talks with the Taliban. We've got a situation in Pakistan which, you know, to outsiders just seems to get scarier by the day. Do we have anything to look forward to in the region?
We have some opportunities in the region, so it's not all black. India, for one, is very engaged. They continue to grow at 6%, 7%. They're talking about growing at 8 or 9%, which is historically where they've been in the last five or so years. So you've got a motor, if you will, on the east side of that region that has the potential to impact Pakistan and then Afghanistan, if that potential can be realized. The Indian-Pakistani relationship is, I would hesitate to say good, but at least it is stable. There is a dialogue again that's started up over the last few months. So you're back into a kind of positive loop, if you will, there. And again, there is opportunity for India and Pakistan to actually come together and find a solution to some of the more fractious issues between them. So again, that's another kind of positive angle, if you will. Afghanistan, lots and lots of questions. But if you talk to people who've recently been into Afghanistan, they will say things are actually looking up in Afghanistan. Security is better than it has been in recent years. It's far from perfect. There are many, many concerns that as ISAF forces, as US forces pull out, that's going to have a huge impact on the economy in Afghanistan. So there's a lot of debates going on now as to, and this is what the, in large part, what the Bonn meeting was a couple of weeks ago, is can we actually ensure that the United States and some of the other international community members continue to invest in Afghanistan, which is what they're really going to need post-2014. So there are some positive signs. I would not be overly optimistic towards the future in the next year in that region, though.
Okay. And Daniela, you know, you've been in Afghanistan a fair bit. Do you sense that there is a sort of a slight mood of optimism that, you know, that there are better days around the corner? Or are you a bit more
sceptical? Well, here I'd have to be a cynical old journalist and disagree entirely with what Zainia said. I really wish that things seemed brighter and people in Afghanistan are really overdue a bit of luck. But the security situation in some ways isn't as bad as it has been, but there's huge room for improvement. And the last year has seen a worrying rise in violence and in a new phenomenon, which has been, people say that there's a list and the Taliban and their allies are picking people off. There's been a number of very high-profile assassinations, including Hamid Karzai's brother and the negotiator with the Taliban, the Western police chief, and some very high-profile attacks in the centre of Kabul, the Intercontinental, for instance, which shows that they've still got the capability of carrying out these very, very dramatic attacks. Now, no one really expects a peaceful transition in 2014. The army has been trained fairly well. The police force is still a lot of troubles, and you need the police force to keep some kind of stability in the country. And the Bonn conference, okay, we were focusing on economic aid and rebuilding, but Afghanistan is so corrupt and so insecure that so many billions of in aid money has been spent there, and it just gets funneled away. So I wish I could be more optimistic, but I'm not very.
That was Daniela Pellard ending that excerpt from the global briefings on Asia that we can enjoy if we go to the Monocle 24 website. I'm happy to say I'm joined by the foreign editor of Monocle, Steve Bloomfield.
Hello.
That excerpt was a desperate search for optimism in an area which is so volatile and so fragmented.
It was, yes. We got mildly more optimistic later on in that programme. There are sort of shards of optimism.
The difficulty that everybody was saying, though, is that this is, I think it was one of the contributors said, India and Pakistan are actually engaged in dialogue and have been for the last 3 months. And you think, well, this is great, but I can tell you, you know, what's betting that in 2 or 3 months' time, all bets will be off and we'll be back to square one again?
Well, indeed. And you've also got to look at, you know, what your base position there is. And yeah, the fact that they're sort of talking about sort of talking is seen as great progress. And obviously there's still huge problems to solve between India and Pakistan internally, let alone, you know, how that's going to play out in Afghanistan. Because they both want different things. Pakistan wants, Afghanistan as a bit of a client state, and India wants something similar.
And things are happening so quickly, because in the time that it's taken for you to record that discussion and now, obviously the Taliban have opened this office in Qatar, which obviously is an indication that they are ready to talk about talking, but they've cut out Pakistan and they've cut out Hamid Karzai from the whole process. So people are sort of forming alliances in this region in a very sort of almost haphazard way.
Well, no, I think it's, these things happen gradually and, step by step, and you know, you can have a vague roadmap, but it doesn't always follow a particular path. And the decision of the Taliban to open an office in Qatar, and Qatar's decision to accept that, the Saudis' decision to accept that it's there rather than Saudi, Hamid Karzai has now come on board with it as well, is a small positive step towards, I wouldn't like to say, an eventual, peace process, let alone peaceful solution. But at least there are different avenues that are being explored that are more peaceful.
Now, that was just a tiny snippet of the Asia discussion.
Yes.
What else is in the Asia discussion?
Well, the Asia discussion is more sort of meandering, I think it's fair to say, than the others, because, we're talking about such a vast continent. We go from Afghanistan across to Japan. So there's some talk of China, there's some talk of Indonesia, there's a bit of talk about the Stans as well. So it covers a lot of ground. And Daniela and Zainia are both very well-travelled people who really know the continent extremely well. So it's well worth downloading, which you can get either from iTunes or from monocle.com/24/globalbriefings.
You've preempted what my question was, which is where can we hear this? Thank you very much indeed.
That's quite right.
Steve Bloomfield, Monocle's foreign editor. Well, in a moment, we'll be back examining whether having an optimistic outlook on life can do you more harm than good. Time though for some music. This is Mika Snow and Animal. That's Mika Snow on Monocle 24 and Annabelle. You're listening to Midori House.
Every week, Monocle's Jonathan Openshaw takes a look at the inspirational people behind some of the world's most fascinating businesses. We'll find out what they've learned from their triumphs and mistakes, how they manage their time, and what drives them on to success. No bulls or bears, just real people, real businesses, and real stories. That's The Entrepreneurs, presented in association with Pictet, premiering every Wednesday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24, and also available on our Timeshift player at monocle.com and via iTunes.
Section D is Monocle's weekly design show, hosted by me, Hugo MacDonald. It's a show about the things that we live with, the stories behind them, and the industries around them. From the paper clips on your desk, to the furniture in your home, the shops on your doorstep, to the signs that direct you to them.
What Japan offers up in terms of graphic design and architecture, you just cannot miss it. You have to go.
Section D is about craft, design, fashion, architecture and graphics in all their guises.
That's Section D, premiering every Tuesday at 1900 London time, here on Monocle 24.
And the time is just coming up to 21 minutes past the hour here on Monocle 24. We turn now to the question of optimism. We're told to have a sunny disposition, or arguably not to have too miserable an outlook on life. But does it help us in the long run? Well, Tally Sharrett is the author of The Optimism Bias, a new book which claims that humans are hardwired to look at the brighter side of life. I'm very pleased to say she joined us in the studio here at Midori House. A very warm welcome to you, Tally. What exactly is the optimism bias?
So the optimism bias is our tendency to expect the future to be slightly better than what it ends up being. So it's the difference between our expectations and the outcome, where people overestimate the likelihood of positive events in their lives, such as a high salary, having very gifted kids, and underestimate the negative events in their lives, such as divorce, cancer, being in a car accident.
And when you say that you've identified this bias, did you do it because you found society did it, or are our brains hardwired to it? What's the evidence to back it up?
So this is actually something that's been known for quite a while. It's not something that I discovered. And the evidence is, the good thing about the optimism bias, it's really easy to measure. So you just ask people about their expectations and then you measure the outcome. So for example, one study that we did is we had students come in and tell us which events they think were going to happen in the next month. Do you think you're going to get stuck in traffic? Do you think you're going to see a movie that you like? Do you think you're going to get a gift? And then we had them come at the end of the month and tell us which events happened and which didn't. And what we found was that they expected many more positive events to occur than negative ones. And at the end of the month, actually, there was no difference in the number of negative and positive events. So this is just one example.
So you're now able to, as a scientist, assess optimism objectively, because I think if someone asked the average person in the street as to what do you consider to be optimistic, it's a very, very subjective thing to gauge. Because if you're a naturally despondent person, you'll say, well, you know, just making it through the next half hour will be a bonus. But you're able to now put a sort of, to quantify optimism.
Yeah, well, the thing is with optimism and the optimism bias is that it is a trick that our brain plays on us. We're not aware of it. So you are not aware of your optimistic bias, right? And that's the way it works, because you think your expectations are real, you think they're realistic, but actually our brain kind of plays a trick on us where we have a bit positive more expectations that the actual outcomes show. And the optimism bias doesn't mean that everyone expects everything to be great and that we're not all walking around happy, you know, jumping in the street. No, what it simply means is that you just think things are going to be a little bit better. So it doesn't mean you can even think that you're not going to do well on something. But if you end up doing even worse, well, that's still an optimistic bias.
So it is a totally irrational state that we're all living in then.
Well, it is...
Happily irrational.
Yeah, it's unrealistic, but it has all these benefits to it. I mean, we are probably hardwired to be optimistic or to have this optimism bias because they are positive outcomes of it. So people who are optimistic tend to live longer, tend to be healthier, tend to make more money, and it is also has positive effects on our personal life, on our well-being, on our happiness. And that's why I think we developed to have this kind of irrational, so to call it.
So there is a practical benefit to being optimistic in life. When you talk about, you know, optimism with an individual, you sometimes hear about, for example, the British as a nation being a generally pessimistic country. Mm-hmm. How does your study translate into looking at how, you know, various countries approach optimism?
Well, the difference between British people and maybe, let's say, American people...
The rest of the world.
...is not that your or our brains are different. Our brains are the same, right? And so it's hardly... it's unlikely that this bias will not exist. And all of my studies were actually carried out here in Britain, so except for maybe one study that was carried out in the US. The difference is in how people perceive themselves. Because culturally, it's more accepted in the UK to say that you're realistic or pessimistic, and maybe culturally it's more accepted to say that you are an optimist in the US, for example. So therefore, people here will say that they're realistic and people there might say they're optimistic, but the bias is so fundamental that it doesn't differ. We even see it in animals. We see it in birds. We see it in mice. It crosses gender, it crosses race, it crosses age.
How do you see it in animals?
Well, the experiment that has been done is that animals were taught, for example, when they hear a short auditory tone like that, to press a red lever. And if they did it, they got an immediate food reward. So this was a positive outcome for the birds. And then they were taught that when they hear a long auditory tone, 10 seconds, like that, they have to press a left lever and then they would get a food reward, but only after a delay. So they had to wait around for the food. So they weren't that happy. This is a relatively negative outcome. Now the question, what happens when they hear a medium auditory tone, a 6-second tone, for example? What do? Do they press the right lever expecting that they will get an immediate reward, which they'll be happy about? Or would they press the left lever suggesting that they expect a delayed reward? Now they have to get it right, because if they don't get it right, they get nothing at all.
Poor birds.
And what they found was that most birds press the right lever, meaning they expected a positive outcome. And even if you went up to 7 seconds and 8 seconds, many of the birds still pressed the right lever, meaning they expected positive outcomes, even though there was no evidence for them to do so.
I mean, you're talking about a massive universal concept here, going right down from a bird to you and me. Do you ever get examples of anomalies? Because you're going to obviously get someone who is either excessively competitive or excessively optimistic or unrealistically optimistic. I mean, where do they fit into the scale?
Yeah. So what we found is, and not us, so in most studies, what is shown is that about 80% of the population have an optimistic bias. The rest is 20% of the population. A large chunk of them tend to be depressed, with mildly depressed individuals being more realistic about the future, the better at predicting outcomes, and severely depressed individuals having a pessimistic bias, which they expect things to be worse than they end up being. Within the healthy 80% individuals, you do have the extreme optimists, but most of us tend to be mildly optimistic. So we don't think we're going to win the lottery. We don't think that we're going to be, you know, the president or a Hollywood star, but our expectations are slightly better.
I mean, the optimism bias is not necessarily responsible for just good things, though. I mean, arguably, the optimism bias might have had something to do with the economic crash, the global crash, where everybody placed their bets on an absolutely unrealistic outcome. So it can have a really sort of quite negative effect, can't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you underestimate your risks, you might not go to medical screenings. You might not buy insurance. You might not put a helmet on when you cycle. And as you said, an example of the consequences of the optimism bias is a 2008 financial downfall, where quite a few economists have named the optimism bias as a core reason for the financial downfall, where individuals and financial officials and government officials all thought that the market will go up and up, and actually ignored evidence to the contrary, and that ended up be quite devastating. this is why it is extremely important to be aware of the bias. Because if we are aware of the bias, we can then take actions to protect ourselves. And the British government has already taken actions. So in their Green Book, which is a book of recommendations for project appraisers, they say there is an optimism bias, and therefore the government projects have to be adjusted. Their costs have to be adjusted for the optimism bias. And the 2012 Olympic budget has already been adjusted. And it's one, as I understand it, one of the first Olympic budgets to be on target. So
fascinating stuff, because one would appear that that would just be the government being miserable in the out, you know, in the general scheme of things in terms of what's happening in the next few hours. But no, you've actually managed to nail it down to a scientific reality. Thank you very much indeed for joining us. That was Tali Sharrett. She's a neuroscientist at UCL London, and her book is called The Optimism Bias. You're listening to Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monaco 24.
Essa è Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
And a Monaco 24 target, yeah.
This is Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
Monaco 24
è io. Tämä on Monaco 24.
The proper Jalavet. Monaco 24.
Esto es Monaco 24.
After I'm into Monaco 24.
The head at Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
You're listening to Monaco 24.
This is Monaco 24.
It's just coming up to the bottom of the hour, 30 minutes past the hour here on Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House. Coming up in the next half hour, we'll be hearing from Monocle's very own Thea Urdal about why the Bible is suddenly big business once again in Norway. But before that, here's the news headlines with Christiane Yeo.
Thank you. Republican candidate for President Mitt Romney says he's delighted to win the Iowa caucuses, but sees a long road ahead. The former Massachusetts governor narrowly beat Rick Santorum and Ron Paul to lead the ballot in the first Republican vote of the year. Meanwhile, it's been reported that Michelle Bachmann has suspended her bid for the White House. Bachmann, who trailed last in the Iowa vote, is reassessing her campaign. A young German man recently arrested in Los Angeles for allegedly setting 53 cars on fire over the New Year holiday is also accused of arson in Germany. Prosecutors in Marburg near Frankfurt say they're investigating the 24-year-old over a fire at his former home in the Schwalm-Eder district in October. Nigeria's main unions have called for a national strike and mass protests starting from Monday in response to the government lifting fuel subsidies. Yesterday, protesters shut down petrol stations, formed barriers along motorways, and hijacked buses in Lagos in anger at the sudden doubling of fuel prices. Automaker Ford says it expects the vehicle market to grow by 5% a year for the next 2 years, led by China and India. The company is investing $142 million in its 200,000-vehicle-a-year plant in Chennai in southern India, where its Fiesta and Faygo models are built. European shares fell slightly today, ending 4 days of gains. The fall was led by banks. Shares in Italian lender UniCredit plunged 14.5%. And Argentine President Cristina Fernandez is recovering well after undergoing surgery for thyroid cancer. She's expected to spend the next 72 hours recovering in hospital. And those are the stories at the bottom of the hour here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much indeed, Christiane. Coming up next, we'll be joined in the studio to talk design by the editor of the Creative Review. But first, a bit of music. This is AM and Sean Lee. And that was AM and Sean and Somebody Like You on Monocle 24. You're listening to Midori House with me, Emma Nelson. The time is just coming up to 24 minutes to the top of the hour. Well, all this week on Monocle 24, we've been looking to the year ahead. We've been asking leading figures from the worlds of business, culture and design about their hopes and predictions for 2012. Well, today is the turn of design. And to guide us through the next 12 months, I'm happy to say I'm joined in the studio by Monocle's creative director, Rich Spencer-Powell. A very warm welcome, Rich.
Thank you. Good evening.
And also in the studio, we have Patrick Burgoyne, who's the editor of the Creative Review. Thank you very much indeed for coming into the studio to talk to us.
Thank you. Pleasure.
Now, your magazine has been a monthly go-to for graphic designers, photographers and creatives since, what, about 1980?
Yeah.
What are you focusing on this year?
Well, it'll be hard to get away from the Olympics, I guess. I mean, so far, in terms of visual communications, it's been very much a letdown, really. And I think there's a lot of anger in the design community about the way the visual representation of the Olympics has been handled so far. So we're desperately hoping that it's not too late to pull something out of the bag and give us an Olympics that the visual communications community can be proud of.
How do you mean it's a letdown?
Well, I think in terms of the way work has been commissioned, the lack of clear direction, and in terms of the lack of opportunities for the UK's design community to really show its stuff. I mean, we have a fantastic design community in this country, and I don't think it's been given the opportunity that it might have been given to contribute to the Games. I mean, I know for a lot of people going to the Olympic Games, the visual communications aspects, the posters, the signage and so on, are the least of their priorities. But it's the Olympics has got a fantastic history of commissioning great graphic design. It doesn't always happen. And so far with these 2012 Games, it hasn't really happened for London either.
Yeah, I think many people in the graphic design community would agree with that. As you know, the last few years, the logo has been lamented many times. You've got readers from all around the world, I assume. I mean, has there been an outcry from sort of international design people from overseas emailing you and saying,
I think
a tragedy?
Even worse, I think it's been sort of sympathy, which is right. Kind of worse than anger, I suppose. I think a lot of them were expecting great things from the UK, and so far they don't feel that they've seen it. I mean, going back to the logo, and I think this is at the root of it all, really. I mean, I applaud the bravery of commissioning that logo. I applaud the fact that they didn't go for the obvious. They didn't go for Big Ben or a crown or anything that could have been so obvious. But I think it really has become a bit of a millstone around the neck, because when you have a symbol that needs to be used in so many different ways, as Olympics logos do, it's very, very important that symbol is something which other practitioners find easy to use. And I think the problem with the logos is it's so distinctive, so quirky. I think those people who have then been asked to use it in other forms of visual communication have found it very, very difficult to use such a strong, distinctive visual language. And I think I know from personal conversations I've had with other designers that people have been put off getting involved with various Olympics projects because they just couldn't see how they could work with that graphic language.
Would you arguably say, though, that to have a strong, distinctive piece of visual language actually creates a strong, instantly recognisable brand that, whether you like it or not, will make its mark in the next 12 months?
It's certainly recognisable, but I mean, the Olympics itself has one of these most recognisable symbols in existence, one of these strongest symbols in existence. I think the problem, by and large, has also been that there's been no clear creative direction for the Olympics. I think the organisers have been so obsessed with not upsetting anyone, with covering their own backs, with doing everything by committee, that inevitably that kind of approach produces weak work. And there's been a distinct kind of lack of direction and lack of imagination applied to all the other collateral that goes along with the Olympics. So all the advertising work, the posters, the mascots. And I know from speaking to people who've been involved with some of those projects that they found it almost impossible to get interesting work through that process. It's been lowest common denominator, and it's been characterised by people being very scared, I suppose, because of the reaction to the logo. I mean, things got off to a very, very bad start, and I think that's probably spooked quite a lot of people who are involved.
Yeah. I mean, I just hearing you talk about that, I wonder, because they seem to get in very good architects, you know, Zaha Hadid, so they've gone to the top there to get in
Absolutely.
A great British architect and show off what architecture can do. And it is a great shame they haven't done the same with graphic design. But is that a problem that it's perhaps easier to know who Zaha Hadid is? And perhaps if it's done by committee, they don't know who our top agencies might be. And so they've just gone to the first port of call, and there's not quite an understanding there. I mean, is that a problem with graphic design? Needs to be recognised, you know, in the upper echelons of...
I think that's an excellent point. I think it's absolutely the case that with the architects, they made brave decisions and they've ended up with some really interesting buildings. I think when it came to visual communications, it was viewed rather than as another aspect of the design of the games alongside the architecture. It was viewed more of a service, and it was viewed alongside all the other providers of services to the games.
Yeah.
And I think also the thing that the design community needs to take on board is that perhaps it's a reflection of the disparity between the respect afforded to architects and the respect afforded to graphic designers. And I think it shows in some ways the weakness of graphic designers' position when it comes to their professional reputation, if you like, and the level of respect they are afforded by the client community. And I think that is a problem for graphic designers, and I think it's symptomatic of that problem.
Yeah. I mean, I also think, I'm not proud of the Olympic stuff, and I do think it's a great shame, but I also think it's quite a common problem in previous Olympics. I mean, it isn't until you get back to sort of Lance Wyman and, you know, and Otto Leicker's stuff in the 70s and 60s that, you know, there's a great dirge that went between then and now, and no one really seems to be able to get a grip on their own design community and really get the best out of it. I mean,
I think it's very difficult. I mean, all designers worship the Otto Leicker work from that first 72, and it was a fantastic scheme, but it was a very, very different era. And, you know, he wasn't having to deal with all these partners and sponsors and these great sways of logos that have to be applied to everything. He had great degree of control. Is that even possible these days? I'd like to think it is, but...
I think it would be difficult to put it in front of a committee with a bit of, you know, nice bit of Helvetica, because I'm sure someone would say that hasn't got the wow factor.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, if you look at the symbol that was created for Munich, it had nothing whatsoever to do with the city, with Germany. It said nothing about sport. It was this completely abstract geometric shape. Yeah. But it worked very, very well because it acted as a badge for a fantastic campaign of work.
We're talking design with Patrick Burgoyne, who's the editor of Creative Review, and also by Monocle's with Monocle's creative director, Rich Spencer-Powell. Patrick, let's move on to trends in design and illustration. For a long time, we've had this sort of authentic, handmade, beautiful, real style. How much longer is that going to stay with us?
I wonder. I mean, in some ways, I applaud it, but it's getting a little... tired now and a little twee, and I suppose it's connected to a reaction against the digital world and a search for authenticity. And we can see it not just in visual work, but also the way people are dressing. I mean, if you walk around Shoreditch or Brooklyn, you know everybody's either dressed as a English country gentleman or a lumberjack, or you know we're all wearing our...
How far has it gone? I mean, in terms of illustration, where are we likely to see it in our supermarkets or in our high streets?
It's starting to filter through to mainstream stuff as well. I mean, obviously it's much more prevalent in the very very niche publications or in things like music sleeve design or in certain editorial design.
Even made it to the front cover of Monocle.
It has, yeah. We've had some handcrafted covers, paper illustrations. I mean, I've been commissioning illustration for quite a few years now, and you know, I've spotted that trend, and I think you're right. It's absolutely a reaction to the digital world, but I also think it's a reaction to the fact that most design grads, they use three programs. You know, it's sort of Photoshop and Illustrator. And so everyone's kind of forced into doing the same thing. And so therefore, I think reacting against that, they had to use other tools and return to craft and paper cutting and woodcuts and all these sort of weird and wonderful lost, you know, arts. But I was thinking about that now digital media has expanded so much and we have cameras on our phones and we can film things and there's a 2,000 apps for, you know, for drawing and taking different types of photos. I wonder if illustrators will start, oh, and designers, maybe re-embracing technology and the new technology that is now available to them and not just kind of think that it's only three programs they can use and you know, just expand a little bit more from that.
I hope so. I mean, I think that's a very good point. I mean, I think, as you say, in the way that illustrators and designers have embraced forgotten techniques, it would be great if they started to embrace more the opportunities that the modern world provides. And I think we've seen that a little bit in this really, really burgeoning trend for infographics.
Yeah.
So using data, creating very interesting charts and maps and graphs and so on. And a lot of that is driven by the fact that there's so much data available now. So you can suck data out of various places that you can find it on the web, and then you can represent it in really interesting ways. And there's been a lot of really, really interesting work done with that. And I think there's so much data available now. We're sharing so much data about ourselves. It's so accessible that I think we're just starting to scratch the surface of some really, really interesting pieces of work done using that kind of information.
Patrick, time is running out on us, I'm afraid. Very, very briefly, if you come back here in 12 months' time, how will you, in a nutshell, summarise what 2012 will have offered us?
Oh, that's a difficult one. I hope it offers us...
on the spot, sorry.
I just hope it offers some embracing of the new rather than the nostalgic. I mean, we've ridden quite a wave of nostalgia recently. And I just cast my mind back to the 80s, when the last time we had a really bad recession in this country. And what that prompted was a lot of people kind of returning to glamour and trying to sort of get their heads out of the misery of the day-to-day and embrace some glamour and some really kind of interesting, creative, personal expression. And I hope that we see a similar reaction over the next 12 months.
Patrick, thank you very much indeed. Thank you very much, Patrick Bourgoyne. He's editor of the Creative Review, to gaze into his design crystal ball. And also Monocle's creative director, Rich Spencer-Powell. Thank you too for coming in.
Thank you.
Every week, Monocle editor Andrew Tuck looks at cities around the world and the people, buildings and open spaces that make up the urban landscape. With interviews and discussions of the spaces and places we live in, The Urbanist is your very own urban audio retreat. That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 London time here on Monocle 24, and also available on our timeshift player at monocle.com and, of course, on iTunes.
For a concise and sharply edited overview of the best clips, quotes, and quips of the week, tune in to The Curator every Sunday here on Monocle 24. Hosted by a different guest editor every edition, The Curator will point you to all the programmes you might have missed and is also the perfect digest of the week in world affairs, business, culture, and design. The Curator, in association with Rolex, right here on Monocle 24.
We turn our attentions now to Norway, where the latest topic of debate concerns the most traditional of all books. A new version of the Holy Bible has led to queues reportedly stretching out of bookstores, with more than 80,000 copies sold in the last 3 months. In a moment, we'll be joined by the man who commissioned the project from the Norwegian Bible Society. But first, to help us through this new linguistic morass, here's Monocle's very own Norwegian narrator, Thea Årdal. She joins me to compare the two. Thea, thank you very much for getting your translation hat on. Very briefly, what's the main difference that you've spotted between the old and the new one?
Well, I would say it has mainly to do with the language. Obviously, I would say, I don't know if I'm a little bit old fashioned, but I would say it's more poetic, the old version.
Well, so, let's have a listen to the old version first.
Ta jeg morgenrøden svinger på og slår meg ned der havet ender, så fører du meg også der din høyre hånd. Den holder meg fast. For du har skapt mitt indre. Du har vevd meg i mors liv. Jeg takker deg fordi jeg er skapt på skremmende, underfullt vis. Underfulle er dine verk. Det vet jeg så vel. Mine ben var ikke skjult for deg da jeg ble skapt i lønndom og ble formet i jordens dyp.
Now, Terry, I'm afraid to say my Norwegian is a touch rusty.
Really?
So you'll have to explain to us what we've just listened to.
Well, this is the Psalm 131, and it's a very beautiful verse. And I would say the difference is, we'll hear the new version in a second. It's mainly to do with specific words.
Well, let's listen to the new.
Yeah. Tar jeg soloppgangen svinger og slår meg ned der havet ender. Da fører din hånd meg også der. Din høyre hånd holder meg fast. For du har skapt mine nyrer. Du har vevd meg i mors liv. Jeg takker deg for at jeg er så underfullt laget. Underfulle er dine verk. Det vet jeg så godt. Knoklene mine var ikke skjult for deg, da jeg ble laget på hemmelig vis og vevd dypt i jorden.
Theo, we're going to play that age-old game of Norwegian biblical spot the difference. What were the differences that you found between the two versions?
Well, I say the main difference here is the one kind of linguistic twist here, where one word is it says my inner self has been quite directly translated into kidneys. That's one of the things I spotted quite quickly. I don't know if I'm just very old-fashioned, I think, about my biblical preferences, but I would say that I find more, it's the older version is the most more harmonic one. And it's a bit more poetic.
And friends and family in Norway, what have they said?
Well, I just spoke to my 86-year-old grandmother, and she has close ties with the Bible. But she obviously prefers the older version, mainly because of the same reason. I guess we're quite late in that sense. But she prefers the poetry and the language. I guess they're trying to make it more approachable for a younger audience. But I guess that even though I'm just approaching 25, I guess I am a little bit...
Taya, stay with us, because I think we're now joined on the phone by Dag Smimo, who's the project manager for the Norwegian Bible Society. Dag, a warm welcome to Midori House. The young and old seem to be preferring the poetical version of the old translation. What would you say to that?
Well, first of all, we say that the reason for making a new translation is that every new generation should have a new translation. That's one thing. The language is so changing over the years that a new generation needs a new translation. That's the main thing, actually. So no surprise that the 86-year-old grandmother prefers the old ones, because that's the one she's used to. But when I find in my bookshelves, I find different Bibles from different ages, and I say that, okay, for myself, I'm around 60 now. The translation from the 1978 was good enough, but not for my children and not for my grandchildren, because the language is changing and we need to update it in this respect. The other thing is that when she reacted on the inner self and the kidneys, it's actually going back to the original thing, the Hebrew thing, because the Hebrew text is much more into the physical things than we have made it into a more poetical thing. So it's actually going back to the roots of the original languages.
So when you said that you were tailoring your Bible for this generation, what did you try and introduce into the translation which was absent from previous versions?
It's going back, in a way, to the more original word-by-word translation and not just the idiomatic meaning of the things, which is, I think, a good thing, because now we can even more see how the original was done. And it's also a thing about sometimes people think that the Bible text should be more very poetical and very high-level language, but the original text in Hebrew and the Greek are very common daily language things. So we need to get the same sort of flavor on the language as the original text was, which again speaks to me today.
Dag, this is Thea here. I just found in the new version a simple version, but I particularly want to highlight the pronunciation of, well, Virgin Mary, and the Virgin has been turned into young girl. Maybe you can elaborate a little bit on that.
Yeah, that's in Isaiah 7:14, not in the New Testament, but in the Old Testament, the prophecy, because the word used there in the Hebrew text, not in the Septuaginta Greek text translated later on, but in the Hebrew text, normally means a young girl or a young lady. But still, the Matthew and Luke Gospels, they use the Greek word for virgin, and so do we as well. So she's still a virgin, Mary. No problem.
Doug, I mean, what has astonished this this event, and what has obviously catapulted it into the headlines, is the fact that there are 80,000 copies now sold and people are queuing out of bookstores. Why do you think this has happened?
Well, I think one thing is that we did our good job in a good way, preparing for the marketing and the sales. The other thing is that it is a good translation, and people have been waiting for the new translation for 33 years now. And there's also these things that we used not only the Hebrew and Greek experts in the language, but we also used Norwegian authors, like the most famous ones. They were part of the translation work itself, which again means that they approved the quality of the book as such. And some of them said that this has been the most important project I've ever done in my work as an author. So this gave approval to the project. And the other thing is, as we said, when I took up this project as the launching responsible, I said that we should do the same as Harry Potter and Apple company does. We will have to make an expectation for it. So we said, this book will be available on the 19th of October, not before that. Whoever asked for the book before that will never get it.
Who would have thought making something that is so traditional, absolutely so modern and so popular? Doug Smemo, the project manager for the Norwegian Bible Society, thank you very much indeed. And Thea Årdal, Norwegian translator extraordinaire from Midori House, thank you very much indeed for joining me too. Well, we're out of time for this Wednesday's edition of Midori House. Today's show was produced by Dawn Trump, research by Tom Hall, and our studio manager was Alex Funnell. Steve Bloomfield and Ted Kravitz will be bringing you the Monocle Daily in 3 hours' time. They'll be talking about rudeness and music across Africa. That's at 2200 hours London time. We're back with Midori House at the same time tomorrow. The headlines are next, but first, taking us up to the news, this is Stillness and the Move by Dirty Projectors. I'm Emma Nelson. Goodbye.